This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Steve Israel presumably doesn't have all that much free time. He's a congressman from New York's 3rd District, headed up the Democrats' Congressional Campaign Committee for last November's elections. Whoops. And with all that, somewhere, he found the time to tap away first at his BlackBerry, then his iPhone, and come up with a novel. His first, a satire, lampooning the absurdities and excesses of Washington and the war on terror. He's with us today, this hour, On Point, Congressman, humorist, newly minted novelist, Steve Israel, and his new novel, The Global War on Morris. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What would be the plot, the theme of your satiric take on Washington? What do you think when it's a sitting congressman doing the mocking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at Mitt Romney's heavy signaling now that he is considering another run for the White House in 2016. But first, joining me from Washington, Representative Steve Israel, Democratic Congressman, New York's 3rd, comprising most of Long Island's northern shore. He was head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee until November, co-chair, co-founder, or founder of the Congressional Center Isle Caucus, founded to promote civility and bipartisan cooperation in Congress. His new novel, tapped out on his smartphone, is The Global War on Morris. The Washington Post's Ron Charles calls it spirited, funny, a zany comedy about a secret government bureaucracy unleashed from any moral constraints. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Congressman Steve Israel, welcome to On Point.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
You must be really good at two-thumb typing on your smartphone.
I have bipartisan thumbs, left, right, and very calloused.
Is that what you're doing when your head is down at the committee meeting or on the floor of the House?
Well, you know, I was the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which meant I spent a considerable amount of time on planes.
Trains, and automobiles, right.
And cars, and many fairly boring meetings. So I capitalized on that time by writing this satire, making a mockery of democracy.
I'm glad that you've got enough spare time and spare humor in the back of your mind to do it. Tell us the story, Steve. Give us a sense, a little more sense of it.
Well, you know, I was elected to Congress in 2000, and almost immediately I was thrust into these classified briefings with President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and the upper hierarchy of our national security establishment, and I would hear the most absurd things. And I always knew what I heard would make a good book, except nobody would believe it. So I had the concept but no story. And then the story was born. In 2006, I was on the Armed Services Committee when a top general was testifying to us and apologizing because the government had, through a surveillance program, accidentally spied on a group of elderly Quakers in Lake Worth, Florida, who the government believed were going to commit an act of terrorism. It turns out they were going to put on pink T-shirts and protest at a military base.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And as I sat there, I said, well, that's it. That's the story. A government that goes too far and spies on a hapless, helpless, innocent civilian. And that's how Morris Feldstein of Great Neck, New York was born.
Morris Feldstein, right in the center of this, right alongside Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and Scooter Libby and all the rest. We've got a moment here. Maybe you can set it up for us where actually maybe that Quaker news bite that you got from the general made it into your tale. Could you read a little bit for us?
I sure will.
You've got a special advisor to the Secretary of Homeland Security here, John Pruitt, and he's coming in early on for a meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney in the Vice President's office.
The office was smaller than the Oval Office and more functional. Cheney's guests sat close to the door. The less they saw of the office, the better. Plush couches faced each other, and a large blue Victorian chair was reserved for the vice president. Cheney's favorite photograph from the 2000 election was prominently displayed on a mahogany table. There was President Bush wrapping his arms around his running mate. That was the afternoon that Cheney, as head of the campaign's vice presidential search committee, announced that the search was over, and he had found himself. Cheney looked up from the stacks of papers on his desk, then nudged his eyeglasses up the bridge of his nose. "What do you have for me this morning?" Nothing new. Nothing since last night, the last time you asked, sir. Cheney's sneer seemed to dip, then click back to its usual place. What about that report I sent you? The Florida threat? That one. We checked it out. Turns out it's a bunch of Quakers planning a war protest. So? Quakers. Elderly Quakers. You know, the Quaker meeting house. Nonviolence. Kumbaya. That sort of thing. They're planning a peaceful protest against the war in Iraq. Protesting Quakers. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? Doesn't that seem suspicious to you? Put more people on them. Sir, it's a group of religious pacifists at a friend's meeting house planning a peaceful protest. We can't spy on religious... Cheney gave him the death glare, and Pruitt felt his perspiration freeze dry along the inside of his mouth. Still, while Pruitt's stomach was now grinding, he knew that the vice president's pacemaker had to be shifting gears as well.
And watch out when it shifts up. Representative Congressman Steve Israel reading from his new book, The Global War on Morris. And it's not long before you've got Scooter Libby, his buddy there, saying, here we go again with the Constitution. You know, I know you sat in on these briefings, and this is satire, so you're taking liberties. But the vice president that far down in the weeds hearing about Quaker protests in Florida?
Oh, absolutely. Look, this book, you know, I did not write about events. Events wrote this book. And so I saw firsthand how the vice president, how deeply involved he was about so many perceived national security threats. And I worked all of those instances into this book. It actually, it is in chronological order. I have specific dates when specific things happened. And I try and prove the point that in Washington, truth can be stranger and often more amusing than fiction. So when the government tried to intercept a plane because a major terrorist was believed to be on board, and it turns out that terrorist was the folk singer Cat Stevens, that made it into the book. When Ted Kennedy was put on the do not fly list, that made it into the book. All of those actual events were in the book, and the book essentially wrote itself.
What about Democratic absurdities? Is it only Republicans who are absurd in your Washington? I can't believe that.
No, absurdity actually may be one of the last bipartisan features left in Washington. I quote President Obama in the book. The only problem was that he wasn't president at the time. So I do use some of his words and some of his statements. I just ascribe it to other people. He just wasn't on the scene at the time.
Describe the sort of anti-hero who's at the middle of this, your Martin Feldstein, the sort of the schlemiel from your Long Island who ends up as public enemy number one.
Yeah, poor Morris Feldstein. This is a guy whose entire life's philosophy is don't make waves. He's a guy who, when he gets on an airplane, he will not recline his seat because he doesn't want to make waves for the person in back of him. He just wants to be left alone. He wants to watch his Mets on television and Turner Classic movies as long as they're in black and white. And suddenly this hapless, helpless, innocent person who doesn't even watch the news is accidentally fingered as public enemy number one, a major terrorist threat. By this new program called the National Surveillance Agency's surveillance software. Now, when I started writing about this, I didn't even know about the NSA surveillance program. Nobody really knew about it. So in this case, this fantasy I had about this slick computer that is monitoring Morris Feldstein's phone calls and emails was just a fantasy. It turned out to be a rather paralyzing and frightening reality for the American people.
We would read in the pages of the New York Times and elsewhere about PRISM, the actual real NSA program. I want to ask about that in the time of Charlie Hebdo. And now, I mean, just today, David Cameron in the UK is asking for way more surveillance powers there to deal with terrorism. Let me hold that for a minute. How does Martin Feldstein get so deep in the drink here? He's a pharmaceutical salesman. How does he end up as public enemy number one in your The Global War on Morris?
He makes a mistake. He is a pharmaceutical salesman, and all he does all day is he delivers pharmaceuticals to different doctors' offices on Long Island. At one office, there happens to be a rather attractive receptionist. He takes her to lunch. One thing leads to another. He has an attempted dalliance with her. The NSA picks this up, and through a series of mishaps, he becomes public enemy number one. The entire national security apparatus of the United States government, led by Dick Cheney, is after this poor guy who just wants to sit by himself on his recliner in his den and watch television.
Poor Morris Feldstein.
Poor Morris.
And he ends up in a pretty, pretty tough pickle. Let's call it Gitmo. Lori in Middlebury, Vermont. Lori, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what do you think?
I just think I love it. It makes my day. I love that the congressman can laugh at himself, and he gives me hope for Washington.
I love that it gives you hope. That's fantastic. What if he's mainly laughing at Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, Republicans?
Well, but the fact that he recognizes that it's absurd makes me think he could be the only one, you know? So
keep it coming. A vote for more satire from more congresspeople, maybe. Lori, thanks for your call from Middlebury. What's the response been in your district, Congressman Israel? Are your voters happy that you're out there with a literary, satirical eye on things?
Yeah, they've been very supportive. You know, many of them have rushed to the bookstore to get the book to see if they're in it. You know, and certainly in Washington, you know, members of Congress, we tend to read from right to left. The first thing we do when a new book comes out is we check the index to see if we're in there, and then we proceed to chapter one. So the response has been great. And what is especially surprising to me is the reviews. Reviews have been very favorable. And I've concluded this, Tom. It's not that the book is that good. It's that a book by a member of Congress is presumed to be that bad. So the bar is pretty darn low.
Booklist says, as political satires go, it's really good. As debut novels go, it's even better. That's not bad for a first-time congressman novelist. Are you worried that Charlie Hebdo and the call to crank back up on surveillance is going to make it look like maybe it's not so funny after all?
Well, you know, it's interesting because in a sense, this book, not to make it more serious than it is, was my wrestling match with the debates that I was exposed to between privacy and security. Those debates were difficult. I voted for the Patriot Act, it was a struggle. This country has had that debate since the Alien and Sedition Acts of the late 1700s. We have constantly had that debate. We're debating it again, and this book is a look at that debate in a humorous way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Congressman, novelist, humorist, Steve Israel of New York about his new send-up of Washington and the War on Terror. It's called The Global War on Morris. A little later in this hour, we'll look at Mitt Romney and whether or not he will actually move forward with his heavy signaling now that he will run again for president for the Republican nomination. Congressman, here we've got a lot of response. Paul says, we need another satirical novel about Congress. I always thought the Congressional Record was the go-to source for that. Chris in New Orleans, you're on the air with Representative Steve Israel. Hi, Chris. You're on.
Hi. I look forward to reading the congressman's book. I think it sounds great, and I think there's a good place for recognition of the absurdity in our government that can help bring out some of the truth. But I see a lot of parallels between the congressman's book and the movie Brazil by Terry Gilliam, who is one of the writers for Monty Python. I was just wondering if that was an influence at all, or if you're aware of that, of the similarities between that and the theme of your book.
Terry Gilliam, Brazil, and literary or cinematic influences, Congressman. You're getting the real book tour questions.
Yeah,
now.
I'll tell I did see the film. I'm not so sure that there are similarities to the film. However, I grew up on Long Island in New York watching Monty Python. One of my favorite movies of all time is This is Spinal Tap. So that kind of mockery, that kind of parody of everyday life does try, and absurdity is worked into the book. Right now, Tom, I'm talking to Rob Reiner from Hollywood. I mean, could you imagine this, this member of Congress suddenly talking to Rob Reiner about adapting the book to television or film? So I went and met with him, and he said, "Well, if we do this as a TV project, we may have to do this. Would that be okay? We may have to do something else. We may have to change characters. What do you think?" And finally, I said, "Wait a minute. You're Rob Reiner. You do whatever you have to do to this book to make it entertaining." So we'll see where that leads.
Made in the Shade. Talking with Rob Reiner about your first
satire.
There
you go.
Hey, who wouldn't like that? You've got Dick Cheney in here and Karl Rove. You know, Cheney wants to raise the old color terror threat level right in the middle of the presidential campaign to stampede voters toward the Republican candidate. Karl Rove, you've got here saying, don't raise it too high. Has to be credible. Can't look political. Everybody assumed that might be going on. Are you just playing here, or is that the way it works from your committee.
No, in fact, that is that actually happened. In fact, I end that passage with John Pruitt, one of our heroes from the Department of Homeland Security, saying, "Okay, I'll see what we have in a nice orange," because there was unrelenting pressure on the Department of Homeland Security to raise and lower the color alerts depending on the politics of the day. If you read Tom Ridge's book, he did a book about his stint as first Department of Homeland Security Secretary. He makes an allusion to the fact that he was often, or at least felt at times, that he was being asked to adjust the color level to respond to certain variables. So this is another thing that I took from actual events and actual opinions.
Are you a reader of Washington satire? I mean, you go back to, you know, I mean, Ward Justice, more than satire, but Jack Gansey's got, or Joe Klein, anonymous primary colors about the, talk about a Democrat, about Bill Clinton's first campaign, or Christopher Buckley with Thank You for Not for Smoking, or Supreme Courtship. Do you read those?
Well, why read it when I live it? Number one. Number two, you know, I do. I love Christopher Buckley, love Christopher Moore, love James Thurber. So I'd like to think that my writing was formulated under those influences.
Let's get a call from Lakshmi here in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Lakshmi, you're on the air with Congressman Steve Israel.
Well, thank you. I'm enjoying the show. It's nice to hear a light side of Washington. And I just wanted to share that this reminds me of the activities during the 60s that a friend of mine shared. He received his FBI file through the Freedom of Information Act and discovered that the FBI had searched his apartment in the 60s. He'd been moderately active, but, you know, nothing really illegal about his activities, but they found a actually to fill in these prayer boxes in his apartment.
Kind of Jewish prayer box, yeah. Okay, and
in his shirt, in a shirt box. I think it was probably his father's shirt box that he had given it to him in, and the file indicated that the FBI actually searched this shirt factory to in the auspices that they were building bombs instead of leather boxes and string, you know, to
right.
of the tefillin. And
right.
So these activities seem to be continuing. That in the 60s, the FBI was known to create all kinds of excuses to surveil individuals and groups.
Lakshmi, we've got the story. Look for it in the next Steve Israel satirical novel, maybe. But how about it, Steve? I mean, that was the 60s, and then we had this era you're writing about, goes back to 2004 and more up to date, but really back to the heart of the Bush administration. It's 2015 now, and last week we had something pretty terrible happen in Paris, and you've got people all over the place saying we've got to crank up surveillance again and get on top of this new threat or we're in trouble. Do you have confidence that we can do that without just becoming absurd?
Well, we've been trying to do this without becoming absurd for most of our history. This is what I call the beautiful struggle in American democracy. When something bad happens, even if it's a potential war with France in the 1790s, we respond with the Alien and Sedition Acts. In World War II, we interred Japanese Americans. After 9/11, we started accidentally spying on innocent Quakers. And then when it goes too far, we have these debates about our rights to privacy and the pendulum begins to swing back. I don't know that there's an answer to that balance, except that you've got to find the balance. What I try and do in this book is enlighten readers about what was happening behind the scenes and some of the most absurd and, in many cases, inane decision-making that tried to push the pendulum too far in one direction.
Washington Post says Steve Israel working in the battle-scarred tradition of war satire of Charlie Chaplin and Joseph Heller. Wow. And John Stewart. Wow. Good company. Lobo.
Pretty good company.
Yeah, Lobo in Miami. You'll take that. That'll be all over the book jacket.
Yeah. Tom, my usual company is the 434 other members of Congress. So, again, the
7% approval rating. Lobo right. In Miami, Florida. You're on with Steve Israel.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be with you guys. just to mention one thing, as the saying goes, fiction, reality is worse than fiction because reality does not have to stick to the plausible. Two cases in point. One, years ago, I'm a political junkie, Jimmy Carter versus Ted Kennedy, the primaries were 1980, and all of a sudden on Monday before Super Tuesday, reports come out that the hostages may be freed.
Yeah.
Of course, we all knew there was no chance for that. And the second one, and this one, I don't know if you guys remember, but living in Miami, that was a big story over here. There was a 16-year-old Haitian kid who was going to be deported to Haiti, even though he'd been here since he was 1 year old. And one of the reasons national security that good old Dick Cheney, talk about a tricky dick, mentioned was that Haiti had actually been identified as a potential springboard for terrorist attacks by Al-Qaeda. Like, it was that easy for Al-Qaeda to, you know, blend in with the Haitian population. Just pointing out that the absurdity of reality is even worse than whatever the fiction Congressman Israel can come up with.
Because it does not have to stick to the plausible. Lobo in Miami, I love it, and I appreciate your calling with that. Let me get one. Thank you, Lobo. One more right here from New York. Your home turf. Neil is calling from New York City. Hi, Neil. You're on the air with Steve Israel.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions. I'd like to first very quickly say that I did live in Paris, and I'm patently aware of the friction in the city between certain ethnic minorities. I don't know if you can even call it minorities. Paris is booming with North Africans. I'm sure the congressman is aware of that. Mm-hmm. My question is, where does sensationalism border satire? Charlie Hebdo is going to, tomorrow, I think, they're going to publish another front page mocking Mohammed, what have you. Where does satire go beyond and meet, sort of center into sensationalism? And secondly, is there any opinions on the National Defense Authorization Act signed by President Obama December 31st, 2012, in regards to peaceful protests being acts of low-level terrorism?
Neil, in New York, I appreciate your call as well. Let's go straight to that, Steve Israel. This line between, Neil says satire and sensationalism. Others would say something more dire than sensationalism. But what about it? You're dealing in satire here. Are you sympathetic with Charlie Hebdo and the covers that they've produced over years? Do you stoutly support them? And what about, yes, they're bringing, apparently, haven't seen it entirely officially yet, but an image of the Prophet Muhammad coming back to their cover tomorrow with a tear running down his face after all the death there.
I'm an adherent to Voltaire. I may disagree with what you say. I will defend to death your right to say it. I understand that one person's satire is another person's grievous insult. But when we begin putting limits on the satirist, when we begin putting limits on those who have the right to free expression, we begin putting limits on all communication and all expression. So I believe we have to be very, very careful in not dictating what a person can and cannot say, what cartoon a person can and cannot draw, what book a person can and cannot write.
And what if it had been Obama in the White House during the heart of the war on terror earlier? What about now? I mean, we've got Neil asking about assembly and protest, but there's a wider sort of a mural here than that. President Obama has his own record on surveillance now and electronic snooping. Is it so different from the Bush administration's?
It's along the same lines, quite honestly. And there is a passage in the book that most people haven't recognized. I was with President Obama at an event where somebody asked him about the NSA program and whether it should be closed down. And the president's response, effectively, this government doesn't spy on its people. We have safeguards. That quote made it into the book. Now, it didn't make it into the book as President Obama's because he was not president in 2004. It actually was ascribed to Scooter Libby in a conversation with Karl Rove. But I am an equal opportunity satirist. And so when I heard President Obama defend the NSA program as done with sufficient safeguards and privacy protections, I included that in this book.
Equal opportunity satirist. I don't know about that. I would have to say Republicans get it.
Well, they gave me more to work with, shall we say.
Kent in Dayton, Ohio. Kent, you're on the air with Steve Israel.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. And thanks for the Voltaire quote. I'd heard it, never heard it described to him. with the equal opportunity satirists, if you were to satirize the Democrats, what would you kind of pick on? I know that Dick Cheney and Karl Rove kind of have a monopoly on this tragedy turned comedy over the years. And the second thing is, if we insist on a zero body count and have to sacrifice liberties for that, and then the other side would be lambs to the slaughter, maybe some people do have to die in the name of liberty to keep that balance.
Boy, that's a lot, Kent. Let's go funny first, then we'll get serious. Okay, you say you're equal opportunity. If you're going to lay out some themes that you might work up first time, maybe second novel to come on the Democratic absurdity, Steve.
Well, actually, I do have a second novel coming out. I'm waiting for approval from the House Ethics Committee. It's tentatively called Big Guns, and it's a satire of the gun debate in Washington, D.C. It's a satire of the NRA. It's a satire of politicians on both sides of this issue and how they tend to exploit the issue. There is a
somehow I'm hearing more Republicans under the gun of that satire again.
You'll have to wait for the book to come out and then draw your own judgments. There is in the global war on Morris, there is a senator from New York who tends to crave publicity and tends to find ways to insert himself in front of camera lenses. I think many people know who I may be talking about. So, there are some pokes at a senator in the book. And there are other reflections of the Democratic caucus that I think are fair game for satire.
Other side of this, our caller raises some big issues here about how a nation should position itself vis-a-vis terrorism. Should a great nation like the United States be ready to absorb some losses of life rather than sacrifice liberties for zero body count? Or are we at risk of, as the caller says, being lambs to the slaughter?
Now, I wouldn't go that far. I would say a great nation like the United States and other great nations need to use all the tools in our toolbox in order to protect the fundamental rights of liberty and democracy and free expression. In the modern world, in the ancient world, people lost their lives in the pursuit of freedom. We did it in World War II. We continue to do it. It is a tragic aspect of the fight for freedom, but one that we have always accepted. What we need to do is make sure that we are using not just our hard power, but our soft power, education, the promotion of women's rights, economic empowerment, in order to spread democracy and freedom.
We're going to talk politics about Mitt Romney in a moment. Let's talk politics with you for just 1 minute. During the same period you were writing and getting this published, and you headed up the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, you lost the House. Why? What happened there? Too much time on the smartphone, Congressman?
Well, no. Look, we didn't lose the House. The Republicans already had
the
majority.
Congress. Yeah, oh, that's all.
Yeah, that's all. Right. My job was, as chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, was on the House side of the ledger.
How'd that go?
And I'll tell you, this was not good. Not good. We were up against an absolute tsunami. In 2010, people remember that Tea Party tied. The mood was so bad, we lost 63 seats. Democrats lost 63 seats in the House of Representatives. In 2014, the mood was actually worse than 2010.
So maybe Americans don't think Republicans are so absurd.
Seats. No, I believe that both parties, no party has a monopoly on absurdity. Both parties can claim their fair share. We had an election in November where one third of the voters chose either a Democrat or Republican. Two thirds stayed home because they didn't believe either party understands what they're going through.
We're going to talk about Mitt Romney in a moment and Jeb Bush. If it's one of those as the Republican nominee in 2016, which would you choose to run against whoever the Democrat is? We know you're there, Congressman Israel.
Oh, you were asking me that question.
Yeah, I am.
I know. I'm paralyzed. I'm perplexed. I'm trying to figure out who the Democratic nominee is going to
Never
be.
Never mind that.
They
you
don't invite
run
me to the
one.
Meetings, Tom.
You want to run against Mitt or Jeb?
You know what? Since I'm not running against either, I'm going to give you the congressional response and say no comment.
Oh, okay. Satire rolls right on. The Global War on Morris is the new first novel from New York Congressman Steve Israel. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Congressman, thanks for being here. Fun talking with
you.
Thank you. Up next, we look at Mitt Romney. Will he put his hat back in the ring? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last week, Mitt Romney told a group of donors, high rollers, that he was considering running for president a third time. Heavy signaling is the kind of phrase you're hearing now about Romney getting back in that game. If he does, it's big news for the GOP field, perhaps especially for Jeb Bush. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. She's got a byline on a Washington Post story, yesterday, today, saying Romney moves to reassemble campaign team for almost certain, quote-unquote, 2016 bid. Karen, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
What is going on?
Well, I think that when Mitt Romney made his comments on Friday to a group of donors, you know, which is not probably the most opportune place to make an announcement of this sort, people didn't really know how seriously to take this. But the fact is, in the days since then, the former governor has been all over the telephone calling his former running mate, calling people like Newt Gingrich, lining up operatives in New Hampshire and Iowa. And I talked to one person to whom he talked over the weekend, and he said that Romney told him, "I want to be president and, quote, almost certainly will," close quotes, "run."
You know, it's such a turnabout. I mean, we got all these statements out of his family that they just hated him running. They did not want to see that happen again. And Romney himself, his little tape, he was talking, this is just October, talking with Bloomberg Politics Care, and he was asked if he would run for the presidency in 2016. He was Mitt Romney. This is just a couple of months ago.
"We're going to find someone who catches fire, who ignites the interest of the Republican base, and you're going to see someone who can go on to become president." And that's why I said, look, I'm not running, I'm not planning on running, and I got nothing new on that story.
Talk to us about motivations now. What do you think is going on here? What's the evidence of what's motivating, pushing Mitt Romney to do this again?
Well, you know, Tom, there's an old joke in politics. I've heard it attributed to Mo Udall. I don't know if that's the case, but the way the joke goes, the only cure for presidential ambition is embalming fluid. The fact is that, you know, he, as with a lot of people who've run for president, you know, he's probably spent a lot of time over the last couple of years thinking, you know, well, if I'd done this different, if I had done that differently. Certainly the decision by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush to jump in December to announce that he was seriously exploring a run sent a signal to Mitt Romney that if you're going to do this, you better do it quickly, because Jeb Bush is going to be going after a lot of the same big money guys, a lot of the same operatives, and also this sort of mantle of being the GOP establishment frontrunner.
Do you think Jeb Bush saw this coming? Would there have been signals that he could read, the former Florida governor, that his big push over the last month to get his name and his intentions out there might have amounted to an effort to box Mitt Romney out because he saw he might be coming?
Yeah, that's what's so circular about this whole thing. When Jeb Bush made his announcement in December and followed it up quite recently with a video and the establishment of a political action committee, the general read on that was that he had heard rumblings that Mitt Romney was sort of reconsidering, and that forced Jeb Bush himself to move up his announcement and decide to really make the commitment. So what we're seeing here is this whole thing is just starting so much earlier than it did last time. You might remember that Rick Perry, who for a while was the front runner in 2012, didn't even get into the race until August of 2011, after the Iowa straw poll. So everything is really being accelerated here. I mean, we've got announcements probably coming up pretty shortly from people like Mike Huckabee. Perry is himself thinking about running again. This is going to be a very big field.
And here was Jeb Bush. This was just last month, this statement. He would actively explore the possibility, he said. And then last Tuesday, he laid groundwork by running launching a political action campaign committee. He announced it via cell phone video on his Facebook page.
"Hey everybody, today we're setting up the Right to Rise PAC, which is a PAC to support candidates that believe in conservative principles to allow all Americans to rise up. If you're interested, go to righttorisepac.org.
Jeb Bush. Okay, do a little prognostication for us? Let's say that they both get in. First of all, is there room for both these guys on that stage when we see the next round of debates for the Republican nomination? And if Bush and Romney are both out there, how do they position themselves vis-a-vis one another, Karen?
Well, Governor Romney is telling people that if he runs, and he expects to do so, that he is going to position himself as the establishment candidate to the right of Jeb Bush on issues like immigration, on issues like education standards. So, again, you know, the history of Mitt Romney has been kind of, you know, I think a lot of people have questioned his ideological commitment. And at this point, he is saying, I'm the man for the right. Is there room enough for both of them? Who knows? And again, we still are waiting to see what, you know, what Chris Christie does, what Scott Walker does. But I think at a minimum, what you're going to see is a very different looking debate stage in 2015 and in 2016 than we saw in 2014, which was basically Mitt Romney and a bunch of sort of challengers of varying degrees of seriousness, but, you know, sort of popping up one after another, and he'd have to sort of whack them away. This time, I think that, you know, the debate stage, it looks like, is actually for the Republican Party going to look like the grown-ups table.
Where do you think the more fertile vote-gaining ground is here? On that take the right wing angle that Mitt Romney is saying he'll try to outflank Jeb Bush on the right, or in Jeb Bush's more centrist-sounding right to rise, a little more open on immigration, education, the rest?
Well, first of all, we don't really have a very good sense of what kind of candidate Jeb Bush will be on the national stage. He says he is going to stick to his positions. But in terms of his political gifts, his abilities, we haven't really seen that yet. It does not – you know, Iowa is a state where the evangelical vote is very important. But, you know, Mitt Romney essentially – fought to a tie there last time. New Hampshire is a very strong place for Mitt Romney to go. It's not clear then where South Carolina goes. It's a combination of sort of the party's mood and the map. And at this point, I think it's just impossible to handicap this.
We know there's the bug that you get. Yes, maybe only embalming fluid can drive it out, that bug to run for the presidency. But what about the people around Mitt Romney, the forces around him and what they're saying? I mean, Ann Romney didn't seem too happy to be running for president last time. What do you know about either political or family or others around Mr. Romney, what they may be saying?
Well, by all reports, including what Mitt Romney is telling people over the last few days, Ann Romney is very much on board, and that she senses that her husband is restless and that he wants to do this, and so she is completely supportive and egging him on. I think, too, that he believes there is a certain amount of buyer's remorse with President Obama's reelection, that may give people some sort of incentive to give him a second look. You know, again, whether this is an actual sentiment out there or just the sort of thing that people tell themselves and that their supporters tell them, I don't know.
Lots of callers for you, Karen. Omar in Miami. Omar, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for calling, Tom.
Hi.
Love your show. First time I called.
Great. What do you think?
Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush all the way. He was great for Florida. He was very good in education, which Florida needs a lot. He was great for the environment at Everglades. And for me, Jeb Bush is the middle ground man, and is what the GOP needs.
And what about Mitt Romney saying he's not conservative enough and outflanking him? You think he can do that, Omar?
He could fake it. He looks, and I'm pleading, excuse my bluntness. He looks fake. Maybe he just wants to get elected. Maybe Jeb Bush is too much of a middle ground man to be elected by our base. However, I believe Jeb Bush is the guy we need. He's smart, and if you go by the track of what he did in Florida, he's going to do great for this country.
Omar in Miami says, go Jeb. Says if Romney turns to the right, the word fake comes to mind. We'll see. Thank you, Omar. Mike in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. I think one of the difficulties that Mitt's going to have is the same difficulty he had in the last election, that he wasn't accepted by the middle class. He was seen as kind of more of a one percenter. And here in central Wisconsin, large middle class population, whether they're Republicans or conservatives or independents, they had a hard time voting for Mitt, feeling like he was, you know, their man. They felt he was more of this kind of old school Republican, but too distant from the everyman, so to speak.
I mean, you say 1%, probably more like 0.0001%. But Jeb Bush isn't exactly a pauper, Mike.
No, no, but he's somebody different who hasn't had that main stage yet. He had some exposure in Florida, but not on the, you know, countrywide scale.
True, different, a little different. Still that Bush name out there, and imagine Bush Clinton.
Although,
that sort of
gets us, Mike's point gets us to sort of the contrarian view of this, that, mm-hmm. you know, only with somebody like Mitt Romney in the race is it possible that somebody whose last name is Bush might actually look like a fresh face.
Well, what about out Oshkosh way, Karen, and Scott Walker? There's been talk over time that the Wisconsin governor might jump in.
There has been. And, you know, the fact that the Wisconsin governor has survived three elections in 4 years, has won two, you know, election, re-election, and a recall election, I think makes him a pretty good, strong contender.
Ulwith in Boston. Ulwith, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I really appreciate your program. Thank you for good program you made in this country.
Thank you.
But I think I'll go with Romney because of healthcare program he made in Massachusetts.
The healthcare?
And I think Romney, yes, the healthcare in Massachusetts, I think Romney would be better.
I mean, but the healthcare in Massachusetts that Romney brought in was really the model for Obamacare. You'd vote for it, Ulwith, and you like it. Karen, what does Romney do about that? If he gets back in now... and he wants to be the arch conservative, and yet he sort of helped draft the model for Obamacare. How's that work, Karen?
Well, I can only assume that he would believe that he was inoculated by his last campaign, mm-hmm. where he basically said this was a good system for Massachusetts, but it's not a good system for the country. And he you know, he was running with that same situation last time.
Been there, dealt with that. Ulwith would vote for him. Pablo in Austin, Texas. Pablo, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, I just want to say two things. One, what do these guys have to offer that hasn't been already, you know, the same thing the Republican Party has been offering for the past 8 to almost 16 years now? And two, are there any candidates even out there that don't reflect the stereotype of the Republican Party of old, rich white men?
Pablo, let us pick it up. Let's go to the... I know wealth and ethnicity first, Karen. Might there be options on the ticket, on the stage for that don't fall into those categories?
Well, with Jeb Bush, you have a candidate who is very, very fluent in Spanish. His wife would be our country's first Latina first
mm-hmm.
lady,
mm-hmm.
And I think that he is also running on a, you know, fairly liberal policies on immigration. He's had some interesting language on gay marriage in recent days. He, again, is not backing down from the controversial, you know, Common Core educational standards that have become, you know, a real flashpoint in the Republican Party. So I think there will be ideological diversity. I think in many ways, though, what may be most interesting to watch is how these candidates talk about income inequality. Because, you know, Mitt Romney still has that 47% comment sticking to his shoe.
Yeah, tough. But there's Jeb Bush, Pablo, I don't know, Columba Bush, his wife, could be First Lady Columba. That would be new. Jim in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Karen. You know, I heard someone say something about buyer's remorse for President Obama. I think that Republican voters and voters in general may have buyer's remorse about Mitt Romney. I'm curious what state he plans on running from. And I also think that the public in general has some buyer's remorse about the Bush family.
The interesting phrase. It can fly in all kinds of directions. Karen, first about Mitt Romney. I mean, yes, they went for him in the end. He didn't win up against Barack Obama. What about, let's say it's Hillary Clinton. Now, how do you think Republicans will do the math on that if they're looking for victory here?
Well, that, you know, and again, we're down to yet another family dynasty in the mix here. We're, you know, this is starting to look like Europe here. It's I, you know.
Old Europe.
Exactly.
The Europe
exactly.
of kings and queens.
So how Mitt Romney can position himself freshly and to look – I think in part it's going to have to be on what his ideas are.
But are they really going to be so different from 4 years ago? I mean, what's going to wash away the GOP buyer's remorse in this situation?
Well, it's one thing is if in fact he can make a convincing argument that he is indeed the conservative candidate in the race. And again, this is something that – this is a problem he has always had with the Republican base.
Boy, that looks like a gamble. Is it too early to be talking about this, or is this where the table gets set for our future, Karen?
I think most people, it's too early, but the fact is people are getting, they're nailing down the donors, they are nailing down the operatives, so we've got to cover it.
The cement's being poured way down in the bedrock of campaigns here. Karen Tumbledy following all of it for the Washington Post. Karen, it's always great to have you right here. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, this show is produced by an awful lot of people doing an awful lot of work for you, for me, every day, and I want to go right to that. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross. With help from Araz Havan and Caitlin O'Keefe, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. That's a lot of talent. We're all grateful for it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.